welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. A bison sculpture carries hope for Manitoba's tall grass prairies.
Bison by some description, you would consider it a keystone species, where they have this outsized impact on the habitat that they live in.
The Buy Canadian movement draws more shoppers to local farmers markets.
Everybody here has to make it, bake it, grow it, or forage it locally. So all the vendors are local, and they all grow locally. So yeah, I make sure as much as I can. It's easy to tell when someone's reselling. We don't allow reselling.
Anyway, I remember at the start of this, so you couldn't find any salad kits or any lettuce that wasn't American. And now I'm seeing like only salad kits that are from Canada.
Fredericton's Community Kitchen's pilot summer student meal program hits the mark.
So we got some little boxes of cereal, some oatmeal, Kraft dinner, spaghetti, pasta sauce, Mr. Noodle, some goldfish, bear paw snack, can of soup, some canned fruit, and some canned vegetables, and a can of jerky. So enough to make some meals for a weekend or a few days.
And I know there are some folks who have made the comment before about it being a Band-Aid solution, but it's better than leaving an open wound, quite frankly.
And the West Montrose Historic Kissing Bridge closes for major restoration. New lips will have to wait for 16 months at least.
We're really excited about this project, and we're excited to be restoring such an important historic landmark.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome again. Thanks for being with us. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be your host for the next half hour. We kick off the show in the prairies, where a bison sculpture carries hope for Manitoba's tall grass prairies. Winnipeg's Living Prairie Museum hopes to achieve this through a new collaborative community sculpture called Caretakers of the Prairie. The museum reached out to the Bueller Gallery at St. Boniface Hospital to collaborate on a project for an upcoming show called Tending to the Wild. They're working with Indigenous artist and educator Britt Ross to create a bison sculpture that can carry seeds, much like real bison, to a new garden that will be installed outside the St. Boniface Hospital. The collaborative nature of the sculpture has visitors to the museum create beads of clay containing a diversity of native wild plants. Less than a fraction of 1% of Manitoba's original tall grass prairies remain. Given the cultural and ecological significance of these prairies, efforts are needed to both protect them and promote their expansion. In Winnipeg, Manitoba, here's Ryan Funk.
Less than a fraction of Manitoba's original tall grass prairie remains, and Winnipeg's Living Prairie Museum is taking a creative step to protect it. In partnership with Indigenous educator and artist Britt Ross, they're building Pascual Mostos, a community-made bison sculpture that will carry seeds of native plants, much like real bison once did.
So bison by some description, you would consider it a keystone species, where they have this outsized impact on the habitat that they live in.
Nature education coordinator Josh Perlman says the project blends art, ecology, and Indigenous teachings to inspire a new generation of prairie caretakers.
We do a lot of education out of our building to teach people about the importance of the prairie. Recognize that a lot of people relate to that information in different ways. So we were asked by the Bueller Gallery at St. Boniface Hospital to come up with a project for an upcoming show they have called Tending to Wild, which is going to go up in September.
Visitors are invited to help craft clay beads, each containing seeds that will be planted outside St. Boniface Hospital this fall. Ross hopes it will also spark respect for bison, which have sustained Indigenous peoples for thousands of years.
The gift of the bison, we say it teaches respect because the bison kept us alive for thousands of years. The bison, when you go to hunt one, you offer tobacco and you ask if there's any spirit of a bison or an animal willing to come forward and offer its life so that we can live. So when it does that, when it sacrifices its life, you have to use every single part because that's the way you show respect for that sacrifice.
While visitors craft these beads, they are taught about the biological diversity of the tall grass prairies and the role they play in both the environment and Indigenous cultures. Perlman says they also teach about the loss that would come if these prairies aren't protected.
Yeah, I mean, from a strictly ecological perspective, the diversity of this site is such that we've got species that you won't find commonly elsewhere in the city. And that's true of some of the larger patches of protected prairie in Winnipeg. A lot of what's left of native prairie is little road right-of-ways or patches clinging to the sides of railroads. And those can blink out as development increases.
Ross adds that it would be a devastating blow for Indigenous communities.
It would be a huge cultural loss for us to lose these native plants on the prairies. And like even some elders, like they're not able to, you know, find certain plants. And some of them like haven't grown up even seeing these plants because they disappeared before their time even, right? Like they might have heard about it from their own elders, but there's none of them left, right? So it's already happening. And we need to prevent that from happening any further.
There is good news. Perlman explains that there has been a lot of momentum in changing how urban development is done.
In new developments around retention pond areas and those sort of peripheral natural areas, an effort to restore those back to not necessarily the complexity of a tall grass prairie, but restore them to native plants that sort of serve some of the functions that a native prairie would by providing habitat for pollinators and small animals and things like that.
More change will come from teaching people to love the natural world, says Ross, with the sculpture just one small approach to doing that.
We consider everyone to be our relations, so it's important for everybody to come and build community and see that there's hope for the future. And maybe we can bring back the bison somehow. Maybe we can bring back some of these plants that are, you know, disappearing because being replaced by all these invasive species. And it's kind of hope for moving forward.
Visitors to the Living Prairie Museum can add their artistic flair and be part of the living sculpture until August 31st, after which it will be moved outside the Bueller Gallery as part of the exhibit Tending to the Wild. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
And we move out east where the Fredericton Community Kitchens launched a new pilot program this summer that extends their student hunger programming. Scheduled to normally end with the school year, it will now run through the summer as a response to increased demand for student lunches. During the school year, lunches are given out by teachers at each partner school and by various distribution outlets. The Fredericton Public Library, which is one of those distribution points, has felt that increased demand over the past 5 years. Details with Aiden Keenan in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
So we got some little boxes of cereal, some oatmeal, Kraft dinner, spaghetti, pasta sauce, Mr. Noodle, some goldfish, bear paw snack, can of soup, some canned fruit, and some canned vegetables, and a can of turkey. So enough to make some meals for a weekend or a few days.
That was Tammy McMaster, who volunteers at the Dune Wilson Row Community Center in the Dune Wilson NB Housing Community. Those items are from a new food distribution program organized by the Fredericton Community Kitchens as part of their student hunger initiatives. Normally, 21% of the meals served by the kitchen go to schools in the Fredericton area to help feed students facing food insecurity during the school year. But this leaves children without that extra food source for the summer months. Here's Abby Clark, the Fredericton Community Kitchens Programs and Event Manager.
This summer, we decided to do an expansion pilot and partner with some of the other organizations in the community that we already have partnerships with to offer distribution points where students can go and pick up a lunch. So some of these distribution points are the two local libraries, Dune Street Community Center, St. Mary's Food Bank. So really just kind of leveraging our existing partnerships to be able to offer students a place where they can go and grab a lunch when they need it.
The expanded student hunger program at the kitchen is a direct response to the needs of the city.
We actually onboarded 5 new schools to our program over the past 2 years. And so seeing that growth, we've tried some other pilots in the past where we would send out non-perishable food to distribution points. I guess the feedback that we've gotten from teachers is that the students really enjoy the lunches, appreciate having that. And so I think both the increase in demand for the program in general, but then also wanting to be a bit proactive initiative in meeting gaps related to student hunger in the community. And this was just one idea that had come up from our student hunger program committee.
That increased demand for food security is being felt across the city, including at one of the community kitchen's distribution locations, the Fredericton Public Library. Maggie Parkin, who oversees the library's community fridge and serves as the children's library assistant, explained how that need has changed over the past few years.
There has been a definite uptick in usage of the community fridge over the past 5 years. Everybody uses the meals that we provide, essentially. The idea of the community fridge here at the library is so that it's accessible to anybody who is a library patron. So we see families who are benefiting from it, kids who are coming in for a break from the skate park in the summertime. And we do see quite a lot of Fredericton's vulnerable population, so folks who are facing homelessness and food insecurity, benefiting from the fridge. So while we don't offer full meals, we are able to offer some really nutritious snacks and, of course, the bag lunches from the community kitchen, which really helps bridge that gap for folks who might not have access to food during the day.
Maggie explained that working at the library and collaborating with the community kitchen opened her eyes to the issue of food insecurity in Fredericton.
We are literally putting food in people's hands who don't have it. So the ultimate goal of the community fridge is that hungry people get fed. And it's been really exciting to see that goal being met. We've had people comment before that, you know, they're waiting for some more money to come in for them. And without the community fridge, they might not have had food for the weekend. So that was a very, very humbling thing to hear. It's incredibly rewarding, especially as someone who, as I said, I wasn't aware of the serious issues around food insecurity that we've had here in Fredericton and that have increased over the last several years. So being able to do something about that feels really, really good. And I know there are some folks who have made the comment before about it being a Band-Aid solution, but it's better than leaving an open wound, quite frankly.
Abby Clark elaborated on the driving force behind that increase in food insecurity.
So the underlying issue with household food insecurity is poverty. So, you know, we're seeing across the country and all kinds of research showing that the underlying cause is poverty, and really being able to address that is really ultimately the only way to solve this issue.
Food insecurity has a far wider impact than simply being hungry. Here's Tammy McMaster again.
Food insecurity is all around us. My kids are adults now, but right from when they were little, I would notice kids not going to school with lunches. Like sometimes I'd actually send extra food with them. I would see kids around in my neighborhood and be like, why didn't you go to school today? And they're like, I didn't have anything to eat. But people have a perception sometimes that food security is they just don't have things to eat. And that's not the case. If you're helping a family with lunches, that might free up some money that they can buy something else for their children or that their family needs. Sometimes people have unexpected bills and need to find ways to make up the difference. And having little programs like this that can help can make a big difference.
Luckily, the Community Kitchen Summer Distribution Program has been a resounding success, with multiple locations requesting additional meals each day. Tammy increased her initial order from 10 lunches per day to 20 lunches per day. And just last week, she asked for 25.
Doing a program like this, it's so the kids can come and they all feel equal. Like lots of families do have groceries at home, but sometimes it's just they see everybody else coming. So it's trying to make them not feel any less than anybody else. It's open for everyone to come enjoy. And sometimes they just like to do what their friends are doing. So we never make it seem like they're food insecure. We just want them to know, we're here. If you need something, we're here.
Abby added that knowing she's contributing to a kid feeling safe and secure is one of the things that keeps her motivated to keep this program going all year.
Being able to know that we could help a student who is either, you know, having this ongoing struggle at home, or, you know, if they just forgot their lunch, like who hasn't forgotten their lunch? Showed up at school and forgotten their work and forgotten their lunch, and just being able to be, you know, that helping hand at that time is what's most fulfilling on that side of things.
Tammy finished with what she hopes kids take away from the summer distribution program other than a free meal.
Living in a community like this too, and seeing someone from their community giving back to them, I'm hoping I'm teaching kids about kindness. So I'm hoping I'm teaching the kids a little bit.
I'm Aiden Keenan for the Local Journalism Initiative.
And this was Aiden's last story on Viewpoints, like Erica Butler did last week. Aiden will, as trees give to the wind, try new things during his master's scholarship. May your sails deploy fully with the wind in your back, Aiden. Conrad, Victoria, and I wish to thank you for all your great work.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Back to the other end of the country, where buying locally is gaining popularity in some segments of the population and sectors. As threats of a trade war between Canada and the United States at the beginning of this year grew, many Nanaimoites are taking a closer look at where their product is coming from. Michael Green, market manager for the Island Roots Market Co-op in British Columbia, says the market has seen a 30% increase in customers since January. The same is, however, not true for all grocery outlets. Reporting from Nanaimo, British Columbia, here's Lauren McKenzie speaking with Michelle Green.
I think people were really seeking local, and they know when they walk through our gates that they're going to get, they don't have to check labels. They know everything's local here. Everybody here has to make it, bake it, grow it, or forage it locally. So all the vendors are local, and they all grow locally. So yeah, I make sure as much as I can. It's easy to tell when someone's reselling. We don't allow reselling.
The market is year-round, so what is sold here depends on the season. Green says some of the vendors have been able to find ways to extend their growing seasons or protect the vegetables, offering locally grown produce longer into the season.
People aren't as aware of seasons until maybe they start shopping at a market. Like, I certainly wasn't before I worked here, but people will come up and ask for potatoes when they're not in season yet. And so yeah, there is a lot of why don't you have fruit in January?
It wasn't just farmers markets that were emphasizing Canadian produce. Grocery stores big and small have joined the Buy Canadian movement with ads, offers, and promotions of Canadian products. But how Canadian is the produce these grocery stores are bringing in? That's what Todd Maffin wanted to find out.
Anyway, I remember at the start of this, you couldn't find any salad kits or any lettuce that wasn't American. And now I'm seeing like only salad kits that are from Canada. And
on his grocery runs, he started noticing that not all stores were equal. Some had big focuses on selling Canadian produce, but others did not. So Maffin decided that he wanted to write a report for his newsletter, figuring out where the produce being sold in Nanaimo grocery stores were coming from. Maffin, who became a local celebrity in Nanaimo after organizing a mass visit of Americans to spend the weekend in Nanaimo, went to 8 different grocery stores in the city and audited where each type of produce came from.
We will see in the stores what we buy as a community. If we want to see less American product in the store, we need to be buying less American product. Those numbers, those sales numbers, are what the stores use to determine whether or not they're going to buy it.
He used 2 clickers and over 2 days in July noted down where the produce came from. He determined where the produce came from based on labels that read product of or made in. Products listed with packaged in or imported by were not considered. Maffin found that despite the flashy Shop Canadian advertising, 40% of items counted at all 8 stores were labeled as American, or the country of origin could not be determined. Stores with the most American produce tended to be the larger chain grocery stores, like Walmart, Patterson-owned grocery stores like Save On Foods, and the Real Canadian Superstore.
It was, you know, obviously a lot higher. It was more than 40% was American or ambiguous. So that's disappointing, especially when we are in a season where there's a lot of Canadian fruit available right now.
CHY reached out to the grocery stores featured in Maffin's report. 3 of the companies replied to CHY by email, sending statements about their work to make sure Canadian produce is sold in their stores. A spokesperson from Walmart Canada says that part of their ongoing commitment to support local growers and meet customer demands year-round, they offer both local and imported produce. Loblaws told CHOY they have programs and partnerships in place to bring in local produce from Vancouver Island and the rest of the province whenever they can. In the report, Maffin also found that independently owned grocery stores had the lowest percentage of American produce, with Fairway Market, Country Grocer, and the Nanaimo Foods and Vegetable Market with the lowest percentages of American produce. Paul Sandu, Country Grocer's Director of Produce Operations, says, quote, "The only items we carry from the USA would be items that are not available here or offshore during growing seasons." end quote. On a busy Wednesday afternoon, C2I spoke with shoppers at the Island Roots Market Cooperative.
What did you guys purchase today?
We bought some pies and some local produce, some beets, zucchini. What else did we buy?
Some smoked salmon.
Smoked salmon, yeah.
And do you come to this market quite often?
I did last year. This is the first time I've been this year, so.
Why are you coming back now for the first time?
I just wanted to see what the different vendors had to offer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like fresh produce, so.
I always like to go places that are supporting local and a place I can bring my dog and be outside, so it's just an enjoyable shop.
Well, she lives here and she always tells me how great it is to come, so we had to come and stop by and buy a little bit and see. It's just beautiful. I come from way further north, and yeah, this is not the kind of thing I'm used to seeing.
We go for the best price, so we at the usual supermarket, you know, save on foods, thrifties, that's where we shop when things are on sale.
What did you buy here today?
I bought some mushrooms and a scone.
Do you come to this market often?
Yeah, sometimes every week and sometimes not, but I really like it. It's one of the nicer ones. It's on grass, which I really like. It really makes a difference to the mood, you know, and the music's good and there's all sorts of vendors, but I'm big on the Buy Canada. I'm huge on that. Like, I couldn't find a onion that wasn't from the States in the supermarket, so I complained to the produce manager and the till lady, and I wrote a letter to head office. It's an onion, I get it, but I just got no time for those fascist people down south. Yeah, when they started attacking us, I just went cold turkey, except I did buy an onion.
Sometimes you have, right?
Aaron Grant has been a full-time farmer for over 5 years, selling a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and tending a 2-acre farm.
We harvest most of the stuff the day of the market. You know, I bake goods and do my canning in my own kitchen and stuff. And so, yeah, it's definitely from our farm here in Nanaimo. We're the closest farm to the farmer's market, actually. Yeah, just 10 minutes away.
The Island Roots Market has always been where a majority of his sales are made. He says since the start of this year, he has seen a 25% increase in sales.
It's come across in discussion that people are deciding to buy local and, you know, looking for local carrots and looking for local onions and things. And a lot of first-timers have been coming through the farmer's market.
Maffin says maybe one day Canadians will have an easier time deciding to shop Canadian.
Obviously, I'd like us to get to a point where we have no American product, produce or otherwise. The reality is we're never going to get there because there's just some things that simply do not grow in Canada. And some people do want the choice, and we should have that for people. You know, I mean, none of this is to suggest that regardless of your economic circumstances, you should, you know, go into debt or be put in a precarious financial position just for this Buy Canada thing. There's some people who can only afford the cheapest products, and often those are American products. So, you know, everyone still has to make their own decision. But for families like ours, where we have some flexibility in what we buy, we're certainly going to be choosing to buy not American.
Maffin says he hopes this report reminds Canadians the next time they're grocery shopping to take a closer look at where their produce is coming from.
Thanks to Lauren McKenzie.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
And if you're living close to Fergus, Ontario, or just passing through, you might have had the chance to visit the West Montrose Covered Bridge. It's known as the Kissing Bridge, the last remaining covered bridge in Ontario and beloved local landmark. Lips, though, will have to wait for a while as it is now going to close for a 16-month restoration. The $12 million renovation will run through the end of 2026. The goal, authorities say, is to preserve the bridge's historic charm while improving its safety. The bridge will be fully closed to visitors during construction. Most of its original structure will be preserved. Paul Harriet in Fergus, Ontario.
Today is your last chance, for a while at least, to catch a kiss on West Montrose's iconic covered bridge. Starting tomorrow, Ontario's last remaining covered bridge, affectionately known as the Kissing Bridge, will be closed for a 16-month restoration. Michelle Pinto, senior engineer and project manager with the Region of Waterloo, says the team is excited to preserve this important piece of local history.
We're really excited about this project, and we're excited to be restoring such an important historic landmark and a tourist attraction in the region. And we are focused on minimizing disruptions during construction, but we are very much looking forward to restoring this piece of history in the region.
The restoration is expected to cost around $12 million and will continue through the end of 2026. During that time, the bridge will be completely inaccessible to the public. Pinto says they will try to keep as much of the original structure intact as possible.
The more than 100-year-old wooden truss will remain in place, with only key parts that require strengthening or because the wood is worn out being repaired. So any materials that are original to the bridge that are still in good condition will be maintained. After a very thorough inspection, if the wood was determined to be requiring replacement because of deterioration or to bring it up to current codes, then we're only replacing what is necessary, and we're maintaining as much of the original bridge as we can.
Pinto says a few different design and engineering options were considered before settling on the plan to restore the bridge. One of the options was not to restore the bridge, especially with Line 86 so close by.
We did a comprehensive environmental assessment where we looked at a number of alternatives, and we considered the long-term monitoring and evaluation of the bridge, you know, the reason we're doing it in the first place for the structural capacity. And then we considered public engagement. We considered technical factors to determine the recommended design concept. So do nothing was definitely one of the options that was considered. However, based on the heritage significance and this being such a significant landmark in the region, as well as a few other factors that were considered, the alternative that we have, the recommended design concept that we have in front of us, is what came out as the preferred alternative. And heritage was one of the major criteria considered in that evaluation.
The region hopes to keep the bridge's historic character intact, replacing only the elements that are no longer safe. Pinto says that's important to many West Montrose residents who feel a deep connection to the 19th century structure.
There's the West Montrose Residents Association and also the Bridge Keepers. So they're a stewardship group that takes care of the bridge and have been very involved in the project. And definitely the bridge is a tourist landmark in the region and brings tourists into the village of West Montrose. And it definitely makes it quite the historic landmark in the village for the residents.
Once the work is complete, the restored bridge will remain a key attraction and cultural landmark in the province. I'm Paul Harriet, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative.
And time is running out for us at Viewpoints. Lots of stories are waiting for your eyes and ears on frequencynews.ca. So many we did not have time to include here today. Check them out. Thanks to our journalists this week, Aidan Keenan, Lauren McKenzie, Paul Harriet, and Ryan Funk. To both our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox, Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Take care of one another. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.